October 9th, 2001, from the Wings Archive.
I'm sitting in the kitchen of my home with a dear friend, somebody that I admire very much, a poet. Before I was in radio, I used to be a poet myself, but Susan Bright has been a poet continuously for a great many years. And we're sitting in the kitchen 2 days after hearing about the bombing of Afghanistan by the United States.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I don't know about you, Susan, or I think I do know about you, but I feel very grief-stricken. I feel as if something has happened that's just driven a wedge into the heart of the world now. Maybe it's too late for political speech, or it's not the right moment for political speech, and what we need is heart speech. And I know that you have written poems out of your heart during this whole process, as you always do. So I've invited you here to the kitchen to comfort me with poetry or bring catharsis in this moment, and not just me, but the listeners of Wings. I heard you read a poem the other day on the local co-op radio station. It was called Soft Bombs. And now that the hard bombs have been dropped, I still want to hear you reread the poem Soft Bombs that you wrote thinking about what might happen in Afghanistan. Would you read that one?
I would be happy to read that one. About bombs, remember SANE, the Society Against Nuclear Explosions? That seemed to me so profoundly simple and clear and true, opposed to dropping explosions out of airplanes onto human beings. Anywhere, anytime. It seems a bad idea. Soft bombs. Fill airplanes and helicopters, trucks and cargo space on the backs of donkeys with food and medicine. Airlift tents and blankets. Fly in some cows and bales of hay. Fly in books and radios and justice and hope. Drop feather beds and pillows down coats in every size. Send down mirrors wrapped in bubble wrap so the women can see themselves, how beautiful they are. Send butter and olive oil, garlic and beans. Bomb them with soft tacos. Fly in flowers, drop them by the thousands, and chocolate, milk, and more milk. Parachute in boxes full of chickens laying eggs, and sheep, and goats, and animal feed. Send in foster parents for children who have nobody to take care of them. Drop teddy bears and dolls. Send in crayons and notebooks. Send alphabet primers in Arabic and all the languages the people of Afghanistan speak. Send laptop computers with translation programs and internet connections to circumvent the patriarchy. Send generators and cell phones and satellite connections. Send in televisions and video cams and tape recorders, batteries and more batteries and chargers. Send medicine to get rid of lice and antibiotics and soap and clean clothing, shoes and hats, gloves, boots, rain gear, down comforters and charcoal to build fires and matches and water purification tablets. Airlift bottled water, not for soldiers, but for people, and lumber to build shelter. Airdrop letters from Afghan refugees all over the world who fled, who want to know how their friends and family are, who are a great diaspora full of love and concern. Send airplane tickets to any place people want to go, quickly, before winter sets in and people freeze to death. Bomb the people of Afghanistan with soft things to wrap around their bodies, food to keep them alive, and then set up schools and universities. Follow these soft bombs with administrations of social workers, carpenters, doctors, teachers, civil servants, engineers who can help Afghans rebuild the infrastructure of a land that's already been bombed with hard bombs back to the Stone Age. Then asked the people of Afghanistan to turn terrorists from their midst after they're strong enough, after they have food in their bellies and roofs over their heads, when their children are strong and laughing, when the sports arena in Kabul is used for soccer and not massacre. Drop lipstick and long underwear, bomb the people of Afghanistan with soft bombs, things that give life and justice and hope. Bomb them with diversity and tolerance, creativity and goodwill, because the other way doesn't work, because there have to be alternatives. Airlift bulletproof vests and helmets, send soldiers to refugee camps to protect people from terrorists, and then ask them why Bin Laden, who is fabulously rich, hasn't done these things. And by the way, where is he?
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Susan.
In the light of your largesse, the food that the U.S. just dropped, enough food for one day for 37,000 people, dropped out of airplanes onto the ground, some of it landing in the middle of minefields, where there are 1.2 million refugees who are hungry. Well, that just pales beside the largesse that you are suggesting. Mm-hmm. And the proportions, I think, that the U.S. has dropped things in is totally wrong. Millions of dollars of hard bombs and missiles now after only a couple of days. And so much soft bombs that would have paid for.
You know, one of the most obscene things I heard recently was that after the first night of bombing, they said, you know, it's hardly worth the money to drop any more bombs in Afghanistan. There's nothing to ruin. I just felt like that was an obscene comment. We are in a time in history, because of mass communication, when the world could change its mind. Ellen Pogue, one of my favorite peace activists here, says, we must create an international peace movement so strong that world leaders can't break it. We need a peace movement with peace in it. We need kindness and goodwill and tolerance and diversity and women and men's voices working together. And we need the wisdom of the mother. We have lost the wisdom of the mother in the world for 4,000 years.
Now, you said 4,000 years. I want you to tell about your discovery or rediscovery of Enhedoonwa.
I found this wonderful book called A Book of Women Poets from Antiquity to Now by Alecki and Willis Barnstone. And the first poet in the book was Enhedoonwa. And I found myself astonished that this was a woman who was writing political poetry in opposition to war. And the date is 2300 BC, and she was thrown in a leper colony for her trouble. Her father was the first emperor in the Fertile Crescent. She was a moon priestess of Inanna, and she criticized Inanna for marrying, meaning being overtaken, the temples. She describes how the temples were overtaken by the worshippers of An, who was a war god. And she said that she tried, but she couldn't understand this. So it's a poet, the first poet who we have in the world. And I've checked with Chinese scholars, and there were some Chinese books, but they were stories. And by anonymous people, they don't have the names. She is the first, as far as I know, poet who we have written work from and a name and a personality to attribute. And she wrote political poetry asking the gods not to be violent. So I ask people every time I read if they know who the first poet is, and invariably someone says Sappho, and so I get to tell the story of Enhedoonwa. The poem, and I have her words in the poem, and I'll introduce them as her words, is called Enhedoonwa Wrote on Stone. Enhedoonwa wrote on stone. The first poet in recorded history was a woman who wrote political poetry, was a woman who gathered symbols, mysterious and strange for us to see, a woman who cut clay glyphs in order to catch thought, cut clay words to throw at the goddess. How dull and heavy the medium, sculpture, to chase fleet passages of mind, heartbeat, she said. Like a dragon, you have filled the land with venom like thunder. When you roar over the earth, trees and plants fall before you. You are a flood descending from a mountain, O primary one, moon goddess Inanna of heaven and earth. Your fire blows about and drops on our nation. Lady, mounted on a beast, An gives you these qualities, holy commands, but you decide. You are in all our great rites. Who can understand you? Anhatawena wrote on stone questions about divinity and human suffering, questions about the vibrant green of spring, the black green of thunder, the violent green of torrent, mountains emptying into ocean, war so violent earth trembles. She said, storms lend you winds, destroyer of lands, for you the rivers rise high with blood and the people have nothing to drink. The army of the mountain goes to you captive of its own accord. Her stone words fall out of history, pour and tumble, rough and fierce, into our lives. It has always been so. We have been singing this song for so long. Our tongues grow thick, numb, cold, sullen, snake hair, stone face, over and over since there were words. We have used them to unmask savage gods. She said, you have lifted your foot and left the barn of fertility. The women of the city no longer speak of love with their partners. At night they do not make love. They are no more naked before them, revealing intimate treasures. Words are fast now, fast words. Words deny the violent gods. Words leap through the fire of your soul. Words, conquest kills passion. Words are fast now, fly from river to sky, continent to ocean, parent to child, page to heart. In an instant, the entire world could change its mind. Anything is possible. Planets converge, populations emerge, change, revolt. But it doesn't do any good. We worship violent gods. Anhatawena wrote on stone. That's what she said. She said, we worship violent gods. And she was born approximately 2300 BC, the note said, a moon priestess, daughter of King Sargon of Agade, who reigned over the world's first empire, extending from the Mediterranean to Persia. Anhatawena is the first writer, male or female, in history whose name and work have been preserved. Her personal history survives in highly political poems. We have a stone disc which contains a detailed likeness of the high priestess, revealing her particular features and dress, flanked by three of her retainers. The poetry we have has been preserved on cuneiform tablets.
Hold on while I turn off the sweet rolls. I smell them getting hot.
I'm in the kitchen still with Susan Bright. Susan Bright, the poet. We're talking about war. Susan, in your poem about Anhatawena, you mentioned something about nakedness and about the women not wanting to reveal their nakedness to their husbands and lovers who had become so warlike and militant, was the sense that I had of what the meaning of that was. You have a poem that you've written about the current situation, the one called Fly Naked. And I was wondering if you would be willing to share that poem with the listeners now.
This poem I wrote the day after I wrote another poem about that got into the minds of these fundamentalists who flew airplanes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th, in one of the luggages of one of the people, there was a letter written to them that described a ritual that they were to go through the last day of their lives, knowing that they were going to die, knowing that they were going to do something. And it was full of blessing the space. They washed and cleaned their body and shaved off extra body hair. And it was like bathing, cleaning, and cleansing the self as if they were going to be bridegrooms of the heavenly maidens. That's what the letter said. And then they were to bless each step of the way through their day. They were to bless their clothes as they got dressed in the morning, in the room that they were in, and then the taxi that they took to the airport, and then the airport, and then the airplane. And described a ritual, a holy, terrible use of the word, ritual. And I thought, you know, I fly a lot. I get on an airplane once a month, and I go someplace, and I want to come back. And what happened to the plane in Pennsylvania is a militia developed, and people made the plane fall out of the sky because they knew, I think, that it would be used to kill people, and they didn't want that to happen. And so all of those thoughts have been just leaping through my mind as I try to think about getting on the airplane again. And so this is the poem that came from that. And I try to think of what to do to break the ritual, to throw these people off if it occurred again and I were ever in that situation. And so here's the poem. Fly Naked. I was scheduled to fly to San Francisco a week after 9-1-1 didn't go because I wanted to see what the Federal Aeronautic Administration would do to make flying safe. It was a mistake. I am not comforted by the clips they show on television, air marshals tackling men wearing black hoods, and around this strange behavior, a bunch of crash test dummies strapped at random angles. Something's wrong with the way these people think. At a meeting the other night, one of my more radical friends said the answer is for everyone to fly naked. Pam said, "We are now a militia ready to go into action like the one that formed on the flight that crashed in Pennsylvania." The problem is, I don't really want to die in flight. Plus, I get cold. Maybe flight attendants could pass out extra blankets. Women may be the best defense against fundamentalist religious terrorists who can't look at us in public. A well-aimed, blood-soaked tampon would horrify them. Shatter the ritual of gleaming clean male bodies acting in a sacred space. If terrorist camps had to invent drills for such a contingency, that alone might shut them down. Perhaps we need self-defense classes, counter-terrorist brainstorming sessions instead of suitcases full of clothing or laptop computers. Any teenager knows how to terrorize adults. They could help with this. Rap lyrics on the intercom might do it. I'm just starting to invent outrageous ways to respond to outrage. What about stun gas in the cabin and a sealed-off cockpit, a lovely word, with doors set to fry anyone who touched them during a hijacking? Pilots say they can fly upside down or bounce the plane so severely no one could remain composed, depressurize the cabin. Sort of hard on grandfather, or a new baby, or someone trying to finish a spreadsheet, or memorize fish diseases, but it could save lives. Essentially, if we can keep guns and bombs off airplanes, we can prevent them from being used for mass destruction. It might be worth paying someone a living wage to do that. I got an email today saying terrorists should be kidnapped, given sex change operations, and sent back to live as women under the Taliban. It makes me angry that someone could use my next trip to see Mother to blow up thousands of people. They would have to kill me. The thing is, I take airplanes for less drastic purposes most of the time. The meaning of flying has just jumped scale. it might be wise to blow off the crash test dummy drill and get creative.
Well, we definitely have to get the young women in on that one, because those of us who are past menopause couldn't be throwing the bloody tampons. But I'm sure there must be something terrifying about older women as well.
You know, and I think menstrual blood is so horrifying to fundamentalists of this sort and to a patriarchal culture in general. And there even are theories that the cry for war is just that the men want to be able to bleed. That's an old, strange theory. I don't know where it comes from. A deep flaw.
There definitely seems to be a deep flaw in humankind that it can think up these self-destructive and other destructive kinds of things so easily, and has such a hard time dreaming up the peace scenarios. And when we were standing next to each other at the Women in Black demonstration on Wednesday at the Capitol, you said that you thought that we needed to develop a language of peace. Do you have anything in your poetry that would contribute to this language of peace?
I have a long piece that I just wrote. I spent all day yesterday writing a letter. We have here the local Coalition for Peace Action is called the No War Collective, and they're doing demonstrations against racism and against the restriction of civil liberties, which is double negatives on top of negatives on top of negatives. And so I've been sending out a note saying, why don't we call it the Austin Coalition for World Peace and Universal Humanity. Mm. I think the last word was something else, but we're anti-war instead of for peace is a good example. We're nonviolent instead of peaceful. We have enemies when we could just call everyone my friend anywhere in the world. The Quakers do that. It's a lovely way. And I'm sending out a call to all creative people everywhere, help us invent a language of peace, because we really don't have one. We still think with patriarchal language forms that are adversarial. We don't have a way to stand down with respect. When someone confronts you, you think you have to confront them back, and we have an endless cycle and circle of retaliation. We don't know how to stand down. If you're right, you don't know how to say, it's okay, it doesn't matter that I'm right. What matters is the relationship of people with each other around the world. That's more important than who's right. It's a staggering concept, isn't it?
I can't help but think that I wish that President Bush had listened to you before he got so worked up. According to the press release that I just read today, Bush says that it was his idea to start the bombing. Now, whether that's true or not, I'm not so sure. But it could have been. And I can't help thinking that it must have been because the administration of the Taliban said that they would release the prisoners if the U.S. would stop threatening war. And the only response that they could think of was to do, you know, massive something terrifying. In response, they couldn't start negotiating from that. They couldn't, like, stand down from their own opinion and say, as you said, well, we may be right, but we could still negotiate something.
We do not have, and we aren't advocating yet for, and we must, I think, in the peace movement, there must be a world court. There must be a body of international laws, things that aren't okay, killing civilians, mass murder, kidnapping, ransom. This sort of terrorism that attacks chemical warfare, nuclear bombs. There have to be some rules, and then people have to be held accountable to those rules, and it needs to be international. And when you get into negotiating on an international level, people behave in ways that are institutionalized by their culture as being good and right. And I think there are times in history, and I said this earlier, that consciousness can jump so quickly that people can change their minds, that things can change. And among the things that need to change, since the world leaders seem just compelled to battle over oil rights and take everyone with them. We have other kinds of energy. I mean, we don't have to use fossil fuel. Press your face against the sky. I climb out of the creek and press my face against the sky. Stretch out on limestone, warmer than the air. Light drops points of heat into my pores. Small drops of water linger just a minute. On sunny days, it's warmer next to the creek than uphill in traffic, where wind blows, where a human appetite for power pushes us to war. On cold days, I spread papers in the sunroom where light pours through long panes of glass until my workspace is static with dry heat. In the winter, cats wait for me on a table splashed with light. I need juice for my computers, heat, air conditioning, don't care to wash my clothes in the river. I like to plug things into power outlets. Energy isn't bad. I like cars, too, the speed and convenience of them. My life is fast, so am I. Today, I stood with the women in black in front of the Capitol building. There was a slight chill in the breeze, but sunlight quickly soaked through my dark clothing, warming arms and back, turning my long hair into a blanket. We stood before the Capitol because we want the world to turn away from war. We want America to think differently, act differently. My father and grandfather were oil men whose business was to make energy available to a society ravenous for it. And we've grown hungrier still, so hungry two civilizations careen to a line drawn in the sand on top of oil. 9-1-1 and our elites have pushed the world to a recession. Business responds with massive layoffs, and we spin further down to a depression, and war's the thing to pull us out. We need 1 million jobs. About what it would take to change gears from gas to light. There's light enough for everyone. Invention waits for the right moment. Press your face against the sky.
That was Susan Bright, author of many books of poetry, publisher of Plainview Press in Austin, Texas. I thank you again for joining me and cheering me up on a sad day with your ideas. This edition of Wings was produced by me, Frida Worden, with help from Suzette Cullen, Deborah Weingarten, Maria Teresa Chiriboga, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. This was an archival recording from October 9, 2001. Wings has extensive archives of women speaking about peace and other topics, going back to 1986. Email wings@wings.org for more information and links to listen. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.